So I put on the portal some material. So there is the table of content of the lecture notes, so you can see where the course is going. I also put the appendices because one of them is on Cartan's calculus in case that's something. Well, we will use it a lot, and if you're not familiar, you just find the formulas there. Then I put in chapter one, which is mostly about the content of homework one. And it's more of a like an overview of the problem of quantum gravity. Really, really broad. It's nothing too specific, probably nothing you haven't heard of, but I try to explain why I've built the course the way I did in this chapter, and then towards the end, there is some material that will appear in homework one. Then chapter two is the one we have started, and I corrected, thanks to Nico as well, some sign mistakes that there were. So in case you already had the old version of the notes, you might want to look at the new ones. There is also the bibliography as references. So let me start also by recapping what we did yesterday, because we did quite many things. So we started by reviewing Lagrangian and Hamiltonian mechanics, and my main goal there was to introduce Hamiltonian mechanics as a geometric flow in phase space. Phase space is the space of Qs and Ps, coordinates and momenta. And so we saw that there is a particular vector field that is encoding time evolution, which is built out of the Hamiltonian. Then we also reviewed Poisson brackets very quickly, and in canonical coordinates, they read like this. Again, in your notes, if you copied at the blackboard, there might have been a sign mistake. So this should be the correct sign. That is consistent with the lecture notes and the other formulas I will be giving. Then we entered into a new territory by defining what we mean by symplectic manifold or by a phase space. So here we have an even dimensional manifold equipped with a two form, which is non-degenerate and closed. So this is what defines a symplectic manifold. A note that I don't think I mentioned is that if the manifold were odd dimensional, it would not be possible to define a closed non-degenerate two form on it. So they must be, I mean, this is in a sense redundant, but it's important to remember that they must be even dimensional. The prototypical example of a symplectic manifold is a cotangent bundle. So cotangent bundles are the kind of phase spaces that arise from second-order Lagrangian mechanics. Q is configuration space, and phase space is T star of Q. On this space, we have a canonical one form or tautological one form, which is PDQ. And we discussed how it's built, how to read this. So P's and Q's are coordinates on P. Q is a coordinate of Q, and P is a coordinate on the fiber. And omega turns out to be of this form. And it's clearly non-degenerate and closed. Now, a crucial theorem in symplectic geometry is the Darboux theorem that says that any symplectic manifold locally looks like this, which means that there exist coordinates in open charts that essentially diagonalize omega and put it in the form dpdq. So this statement is not true at one point, it's true in open charts. Now, after this, we related symplectic geometry back to the Poisson brackets, and the way it worked was like this. Again, sign mistake in yesterday's notes. This is a better convention. So pi is essentially the inverse of omega. Since omega is non-degenerate, we can invert it point by point on phase space and obtain something with two indices up, which allows us to define a bivector. So it's a biderivation. It derives objects in this way. And since it's antisymmetric in I and j, this is actually is a good candidate to be a Poisson bracket. Now, this object will be skew symmetric, of course, because omega is antisymmetric. It is a biderivation because I built it that way and satisfies Jacobi identity because omega is closed. before moving on, another thing that I mentioned, which wasn't quite right, was that we talked about these symplectic potentials, which are one form such that d theta is symplectic. And so the statement is that if the second Dirac cohomology is trivial, then this guy exists. So here, I think I said first, but in any case, it's second because omega is a two form. So two remarks here. Thetas, even if it exists, is not unique. There's no reason why it should be. And in particular, I can add any exact form to theta and it would just drop. And second point is that a counterexample where theta does not, definitely does not exist, we gave it, and is the case where P is a two-sphere and omega is its volume element, so it's area two-form. So in this case, there definitely is no theta like this, because if it had this form, it would mean that the total area of the sphere would vanish, because it would be the integral of an exact form over a closed manifold, which gives zero. So it cannot be. But locally, we can always find thetas like that because of Poincaré's lemma. So they always exist locally. And we gave an example for the sphere. OK, so now what I want to do is to start from here and go back to the ideas of these flows, of these vectors. So the point, Hamiltonian vector fields. So it's a bit easier to introduce this idea in the Poisson picture and then relate it to the symplectic picture. So a Poisson bracket, remember, it's a bivector. So if I feed only one function to it, what I get is one vector. So if I have, I can define f, and now this is some vector which I call, let me call it here, xf. So for to any function, I can associate, once I have a Poisson bracket, I can associate a vector in field space, in phase space, and this is called the Hamiltonian vector field associated to f, to a function. So now, since pi is related to omega, I can invert this relation. And it takes a couple of lines. I will not do it because it's kind of intuitive. I just multiply by omega here. And so I have to, so this pi goes away, and I'm left with df. And on this side, I have omega contracted with x. So what I find in the symplectic picture is the following equation. And there is a sign because of signs. So if this equation is clear to everybody, if it's not clear to someone, I can go more slowly and show how, where it comes from. Is the notation clear? Are you familiar with it? OK. So now we can invert this equation. So we know that to every f there exists is associated an x such that this is true. Now, the point is that we define Hamiltonian vector fields as vector field for which such an f exists. So the definition, x in one vector field is, say, Hamiltonian, if and only if there exists an f such that basically this equation holds. Okay? So these are not all vector fields. Not all vector fields are of this form, only some of them. So this is restrictive. Um,
Now, these vector fields play a crucial role in
not just in the mathematical theory of symplectic geometry, but in physics, as we will see soon. So most of the course, in fact, is about this type of vector fields, because they will encode not just dynamics, as we saw there, but in particular symmetries. And one of the exercises that we will do is to interpret dynamics as a symmetry as well. So that's part of what's on the menu for the tutorial. Now, a crucial property of Hamiltonian vector field is the following. X is an Hamiltonian vector field. Then Lx omega is zero. It preserves the, what does this mean? This is a Lie derivative. This is a two form. So I'm deriving a two form along a Lie derivative. And I say that this is zero. So if you remember our analogy, very loose analogy, in fact, between symplectic manifold and Riemannian manifold, this is a bit the analog of saying that X is an isometry of our metric. Here is the analog statement in symplectic geometry. So this X is more or less like a killing vector field for our structure. In that sense, that is the analog of an isometry. But of course, we insisted that symplectic geometry is very different from Riemannian geometry. And in fact, there are infinitely many such axes instead of just a finite amount. They're generated by isometries are a finite dimensional group, whereas Hamiltonian vector fields form an infinite dimensional algebra. So now this is very simple to prove, but let me go through it because we will use Cartan's formula, which is at the center of, is a very important identity that we will use all the time. So how can we compute the Lie derivative of a form, any form, along a vector field? Well, there is this very nice identity due to Cartan. So this is true for any omega. Now we can plug in the fact that a symplectic form is closed. So this first term vanishes. The second term, we know what it is because we have assumed that X is a Hamiltonian vector field. So this is D square, and D square is identically zero. And so this vanishes. So Hamiltonian vector fields are, in particular, symplectomorphisms, which is this analog of isometries, if you want. This is also a very simple corollary of these, is that a Hamiltonian vector field, preserves the Liouville measure. But this is this is Liouville's theorem from statistical mechanics. So I don't have much else to say about it. It's just nice to mention that it comes out so easily in this setup. Okay, before Now, before moving on to do some more abstract things, I would like to bring this back to some physics. So let's give some concrete examples of what's going on here. So my first example is not so much about these Hamiltonian vector fields yet. It's more about why it's useful to deal with these more general symplectic formalism rather than sticking to canonical coordinates and Poisson bracket. I want to give you an idea of what one
can do in a simple situation where I have a Lagrangian, which is the Lagrangian of a particle moving in an external electromagnetic field. So here, A and V are just functions of the position. So they are my V and A is an external electromagnetic field. And my degree of freedom is a charged particle of unit charge. So external means that it has no dynamics. It's just whatever. It's fixed in the lab. And our Q is a test particle. Now, the Euler-Lagrange equation of motion, if you compute them, I'm sure you have already done it many times. So what you get is the following. So this is Lorentz force. And B is the curl of A. So notice that here Q is a phase-based coordinate. So this is a function on configuration space, and B is also a function on configuration space. But this is our dynamics. Now, the canonical, so this is the second order equations, and they have these nice interpretations in terms of the Lorentz force. The Hamiltonian formulation of this problem is instead a bit less transparent. Canonical momentum, as you know, P is dl over dq dot, and this is equal to q dot minus a. And where this is some function of q. And you remember, this equation should be used to define the Hamiltonian as pq dot minus l by replacing the expression of q dot everywhere by p. And what one finds is the following. Let's be q. And the equations of motion read something like this. So q dot is just p, so Hamilton equations of motion are q dot is just p plus a, and p dot is equal to minus grad v minus, and here we have this weird expression. Grad of AJ. So I'm using some mixed notation, but it should be clear what I mean. So in particular, this equation, which is, this is just the definition of the momentum, if you want, but this equation, which should is equivalent to the Lorentz force, of course, is kind of murky. It's not super transparent what it means. But now, the whole point of doing symplectic geometry here is that we can choose our, it's also possible in Poisson geometry, but it's a bit more complicated. In Poisson geometry, it's very straightforward. We can use whichever coordinates we like. We don't have to stick to canonical coordinates. So in canonical coordinates, of course, omega is just dp dq, because this is how we built everything to be. However, we can also decide to define v as a new coordinate to be exactly the velocity of q. So, and in this way, what we find is the following. Omega in the new coordinate, now we'll read a bit more complicated. Well, let me first write h. H in the new coordinates is the same function on phase space, just expressed in new coordinates.
I would have,
well, just to be extremely pedantic, let me do it the following way. I define phi as a function from, let me call it tilde to give it a different name. It is the same function defined on this is equal to h of pq, and it's equal to, where is it? So this is just v squared plus the potential. So now this is just the usual energy. It doesn't, we lose track of the magnetic field. No magnetic potential here. And this is because the magnetic potential does not affect the energy. As we know, the Lorentz force does not change the velocity, so it has no effect on the energy of the particle. So where will the magnetic potential go? It needs to stay somewhere if you want you are describing the same system. And the point is that it will pop into my symplectic structure. So my tilde one will be, so I'm plugging in p in here. So I have dp dv dq. But now there is also a new term, which is a. So here I have the magnetic field entering as a modification of my symplectic structure. So you can see I can formulate the dynamics of this particle either in phase space, either in the usual canonical coordinate, or I can formulate it in terms of whichever coordinates I like, and in particular in terms of the usual velocity of my particle and its position. The price to pay, the Hamiltonian simplifies, the price to pay is that the symplectic structure is now modified. It's not anymore the canonical symplectic structure. It has an extra term encoding in the magnetic field.
Yeah. Is this really the mechanical momentum, or is that a different thing?
Sorry?
Is this really the mechanical momentum, or something like this, or is that a different thing?
So this
not
is...
not the canonical one, but I...
V?
Yeah, like some kind of gauge invariance. Momentum? I vaguely remember.
Oh, so V is gauge invariant because P is not. So V is just Q dot. So V will be gauge. So here, there's concerning gauge invariant. So I put it as a question in the lecture notes. So why is this gauge invariant? So what happens if I change A by gradient of something? Well, this will change. Well, I let you think about it. So the of course, the equation of motion do not change. It's interesting to look at what happens from the point of view of the action. The canonical momentum, in this sense, will be dependent on the gauge choice for A. But V clearly does not, because V is just Q dot. So here, everything is expressed in gauge invariant quantities, precisely, because there's no A appearing, and here we just have B. So this is manifestly gauge invariant as well, but it wasn't quite the point I was trying to make, but it's an interesting observation. My point for this exercise was just to show that sometimes having a non-canonical symplectic structure might be nice and useful for something. So you can have fun in computing the... So if you now compute the Hamiltonian vector field with respect to the tilde stuff, so this Hamiltonian vector field over here will have this form essentially, in the sense that the Hamiltonian equation now are just v equal q dot and v dot equal this. So it will have the obvious form, which is easy to read, instead of this more complicated one. Did I answer your question, Mary? I'm not, yeah? Okay. Any questions about this example or what came before? So now another example, which is probably, I see some perplexed faces, so maybe, no? All good? Okay. Another example would be, let's go to some, even to something even simpler. So what if we have a particle moving in R3? So it's the same situation as there. And now I want to look at translations and rotation. So it's something extremely basic. And I want to think of them as symmetries. And I want to show that I can express these properties in terms of the Hamiltonian vector fields. So in this case, omega is again just dp dq. And now I have so these will, let's start from translations. What is translations? Translations in phase space is some vector field. Let me call it x xi, which affects my positions but doesn't affect the momenta. Now, it's rather immediate to show that this vector field is Hamiltonian. So I contract this vector field with this form. I get 0 when it hits on P. Then I have to go across, I get a minus. And so I get dp, well, let me write it in a xi dp. But xi is just a parameter. It's just the xi here. It's just some parameter. So d can go across it. And this is minus xi p. So in this case, I find that translations are Hamiltonian, and their generating function is the momentum contracted with xi. So this is my generating function of translations. So this we knew. Of course, this is nothing else than the statement that P is, is nothing else than this statement that hopefully if we plug it in there, we will get things with the right signs. So it looks like, so this is just that. We could do something similar for rotations, which is a bit more interesting. We have apps. I'm not careful about if I'm putting indices up or down. So what happens if I do an infinitesimal rotation of the Q? Q goes into, I write it here, then I will erase it. Q goes delta. Q is Q. Sorry, let's say xi cross Q. So here is what I'm putting in here. And since momenta are also vectors, they transform in the same manner. So this is an infinitesimal rotation. And now this is also Hamiltonian. So let's do the computation again. We hit first P, so we get oops, no, here is wrong, P, J, and K is DQK minus epsilon IJK Xi IQJ DPK. And the minus is because it went across the P. Reorganizing these, what do we get? We get epsilon IJK Xi I PJ DQK. And here I can just, this is plus DPJ QK. Do you agree? I just switch J and K, and it's just an index swap. So this is, well, in fact, it would have been nicer to do it the other way around. Let me put a minus here and call this K and J. Well, QJ, PK, and DQJ, PK. So now we get minus D of Xi. So this D now can come out. Again, Xi does not depend on Q and P, so it goes out completely. And so this is Q. So again, this is angular momentum generates rotation. It's Hamiltonian, and so we want now to, these are super simple examples, but we want to generalize this to the general case where we have a generic algebra acting on our phase space. Oh, you can also compute, well, we will, well, let's not do that. It's just, we will see the general result in a second. So okay, so to start talking about symmetries, let me start with a proposition about these Hamiltonian vector fields. So let's say, so when I write x, xf like this, I always mean the Hamiltonian vector field associated to f. So I will not repeat it every time. So the proposition is that one has this, this equality. So how do I read this equality? So this is a Lie bracket on between vector fields. Lie bracket between vector fields on phase space P. And this is a Poisson bracket. So we see that there is a homomorphism of Lie algebras where one is the Lie algebras of functions equipped with the Poisson bracket, and the other one is the Lie algebra of vector fields on phase space, of Hamiltonian vector fields on phase space. So this is homomorphism. There's no way I can homomorphism of Lie algebras. And how do we prove this? Well, the proof is again fairly simple. One starts from the Hamiltonian flow equation, which is the only information we have about xf and xg. And so what I do is to take the Lie derivative of the Hamiltonian flow equation, which we know vanishes by definition of xg. And I just take the Lie derivative of this and see what happens. So again, this is application of Cartan's calculus. So let's do it together. The Lie derivative of a contraction like this follows it essentially distributes. So one has to first Lie derive a vector field with respect to the other vector field. And one gets this, plus the lead derivative of, it goes across with no sign because the lead derivative is an even operator, even though I is odd, so it goes across. And we get the lead derivative of omega plus. Now we have to hit this guy. So this guy, how does it work? D always commute with L. And if you want, it's because of that formula. If you put omega equal d theta, for example, you will see easily that it can always be written as d of L of theta, because d squared is 0, and the other term, you can put the d wherever you like. So d of Lx f g equals 0. So now, here we are happy. We got this guy. What happens here? This is 0 because of our previous proposition, right? And now we look at this. So this is the derivative. So let me unpack this term. This is the derivative of the function g along xf, because the lead derivative of a function is just the usual derivative. But now xf was what? Let's remember, xf as a vector, I forgot, I wrote it up there, is just the Poisson bracket. So this is, again, by definition, just fg. So that's it. We have that this guy is Hamiltonian, because we write, what we get is then omega equal minus dfg. So we see that this vector is a Hamiltonian vector, and the function for which it is, its generator is the Poisson bracket, which is precisely what I've written here. Good. So this was a little lemma. Now, the interesting theorem, are there questions about this? Sorry? Oh, I didn't lose it. It's hiding. It's hiding because the D would kill the central term. But we will get there in a moment. So let's remember that I will get to Robin's point later, but his observation hinges on the following. So if I take f or f plus a constant, I get the same vector field. So there's always an ambiguity the generator is not uniquely defined a priori. So there's always an ambiguity there, but here we don't see it because we're talking about the vector field associated to some function. So I could also add the constant here and nothing would change, but that doesn't make much sense in this context. Okay, so indeed, this is not quite a homomorphism-only algebra. I shouldn't have said that. We will get there later, so sorry. It's a hint that there should be one, but it's not yet. Because this is sitting, I'm confused. I'm slightly I'll answer to it later. Usually, I don't want to say something.
Usually we say homomorphism, maybe just up to central extension.
We'll see. Well, let me phrase the theorem and then let's Yeah, I'm confused about one detail, so I don't want to confuse you as well, so I will not done. So here we have, it is all about Hamiltonian vector fields in general. We haven't spoken about a group or an algebra acting on our phase space yet. But here in this example, clearly translations, rotations come from some group action on our phase space. So we want to include those in the picture. So what we have gotten so far is that we have the space of Hamiltonian functions, the space of functions on all functions are Hamiltonian in that sense. So the space of functions on a phase space equipped with a Poisson bracket, and using this operator x dot, which is the thing that, if you want, associates a functions to a vector field, we send each function to a vector field on our phase space, and the Poisson bracket here is mapped to the Lie bracket on P. So I denote this as TP in the sense that it's the Lie bracket on the vectors. Okay, just to remember what this bracket is. There will be many Lie brackets, so it can be a bit confusing. Now, what we want to do, this is the goal, that our next goal, is to relate this to some, what happens if we have a Lie algebra acting on our phase space. In this case, the action will be some vector field, and we want to understand whether we have a relationship between all these Lie brackets, a Poisson bracket is in particular a Lie bracket, if all these Lie brackets are related. So we want to find out what are the relationships between all these objects. And so this is what we're going to uncover right now. So we will fill in the question marks. That's our goal. So this is, let's start with the definition. We need to include our Lie algebra in the picture. So we want G, a real Lie algebra. And now the interesting part is this row. Row is a map such that it takes an infinitesimal transformation and sends it to a vector field on phase space. It's these guys, right? So here I call them x of psi, but it's not the notation I will use later. So in this case, how does a translation act on my phase space? It just translates the coordinates. How does a rotation act on my canonical phase space? It rotates coordinates and momenta. So this is the idea behind this. And what we also have to ask for this to be a nice map is to ask that this is it provides a homomorphism of Lie algebra. And I will say what I mean in a second. Homomorphism of, it essentially says that since I have a Lie bracket here and the Lie bracket there, Lie brackets are sent to Lie brackets. So this is a property you use all the time without even knowing you're using it, probably. It means that if you compose two rotations on your phase space, it's like doing the total rotation, essentially. So you can either do the rotations twice or do it once the composed rotation. So this is what is telling you at the level of the algebra. So again, let me just to demystify a little bit all this notation, for translations, rho xi is just, in the example from before, was this, and for rotations was, because xi here is in the Lie algebra, which is R3, and here was epsilon ijk, etc. I've already written it, so I will not do it again. And here the idea is that the Lie algebra is SO3, but this is also R3. Right? So this, I can always think of SO3 as R3, and this is why I have two terms there. So this is exactly what I was doing before. I'm just giving it a more precise name. And if you can check that this equality holds, it takes, so in the abelian case is obvious because two Lie derivatives, since this is constant, the Lie derivative, the Lie bracket between two such vectors is zero. There's nothing to derive, it's a constant. So this is trivial. Here, of course, is a bit more interesting. I have to, if I want to take the Lie bracket between two of these, the Q will act on this Q and will spit out so since each one is linear, xx is quadratic in Q, but I'm deriving one of the two, so we'll get something which is back linear in Q, and everything works out so that the composition is the one you expect. There is an epsilon, so it will be epsilon ijk, xi I, eta j, qk, essentially, or something along those lines. Okay? Should I do it? Would that be useful to prove that one has this homomorphism in the case of rotation? The abelian case is not interesting. Rotations. Yes? Okay. So let's do it. I will only focus on the Q part. So let's write it here. Qj d over dqk plus the same thing for p. And this was in SO3, which is R3. So this is the Lie bracket between epsilon ijk, xi I, then I have epsilon lmn, eta l. Here I have qj d over dqk, and qm d over dqn, plus the p part. Of course, the p will not derive the q, so they factorize. So that's why I can work with one of them at the time. In general, there can be cross terms, of course, but not in this case. So this is plus the p piece. So here, when I Lie derive, remember that the Lie derivative x, y is xi, xk, dk, yi minus the opposite. So yk, dk, xi. So what happens is that now I will get it wrong, but this is an M and this is an N. So this guy will derive QJ. So no, sorry, let's do it first the other way around. K derives M, so we get delta MK QJ DQN minus the other one, delta J N Q M D over D Q K. Now, the claim is that since M and K are the same in this guy, So this will be, let's write it, JK epsilon LK N psi I eta L QJ D over DQN plus other stuff. So here, it's usual identity, so I will get it wrong if I try to do it, I'm afraid. So, but what you should get is, so since the lib bracket between two rotations is an epsilon, so you should get something along the line of epsilon ijk xii, and then this eta, I think it will require a bit more work, but you can see how this can look like a rotation for psi eta let's say it's plausible, then one has to put all the all the indices. But so at least what we see is that this is quadratic here, so we like that. It will also be anti-symmetric. I cannot see it from one term. I probably need both of them to see it. But it must be because it was in the beginning. And so it will depend on an anti-symmetric combination. And then it's linear in Q, which is precisely what we expected. And then everything must work out. Okay. So, now one more proposition and then a definition, and we're done for today. So the proposition I want to bring forward is, well, it's more of a simple corollary of this other property over here. So this property is the top row, of course, of the big theorem we are going after. So we see that in the case, so let's write this when we have symmetries, so when we have these Lie algebra actions. So let's call it actually a corollary of previous proposition. So if XF is, well, we haven't, I'm mixing up things. I'm going ahead of myself. So sorry, this is something else. I got confused with something that we will do later. So here, what does it mean? What's the consequence of this? Of this definition of, I haven't said what is a definition of. So I will call this is a definition of what I call an action, a Lie algebra action on phase space. So if we have an action like this, rho is an action. So let's say G rho is an action. Then, and here, is integrable in the sense of Frobenius theorem. Now, you don't need to, I will explain you what this means. So, the meaning of this is the following. it means that if I have, so for Frobenius theorem, and let me finish the proposition, otherwise is inter, and therefore, rho is tangent to submanifolds. This looks much more complicated than it actually is, so I will make a drawing in a second, called orbits. And I will denote them like this. So what does this mean? So suppose I have my phase space over here, and I look at a point, and then I ask, where is this point taken by my symmetry? So I have a vector field rho, and so this will bring it somewhere like this if I follow the flow. Then I can also follow the flow in a different direction, eta, and this will take me somewhere else. Now, the question is whether all these lines will span a manifold or not. They might go in crazy directions and not actually form a nice submanifold when I put them together. The statement is this does not happen. These all these lines together form a submanifold OZ in P. And the way Frobenius theorem works is the following. It says that if essentially the Lie bracket of two vector fields is still in the family I'm looking at, then I'm good. So it means that these vector fields are in involution. There are different ways of saying it, but the idea is that if I take the Lie bracket of rho xi and rho eta and I get again something in my family, then I'm assured that this whole thing will span a submanifold. So this is a complicated way of stating something actually simple. So keep in mind the simple statement. I just wrote that for completeness. The simple statement is that if I look at where my point is taken by my symmetry action in phase space, this will span a submanifold, which is quite intuitive, right? So, yes?
Is that the contents of Frobenius' theorem?
Frobenius' theorem says that if, integrability in the sense of Frobenius' theorem is this property that two vectors, my family of vectors is in involution. And Frobenius' theorem states that if this is the case, so this is the definition of integrability.
Sorry, I don't know the word of involution. That means it's a Lie algebra homomorphism. That's what's implied?
Well, in this case, yes. It's more general, but in this case, it's that. So if we have a Lie algebra homomorphism, we have an integrable distribution by definition, because that what I'm... Integrable means that this holds in this case, in this scenario. And Frobenius' theorem guarantees the hard statement, that is this global statement, that there is a submanifold of P for which that integrates it.
Okay. So it's the non-trivial claim is that you can integrate the Lie algebra into a submanifold.
Yes. So you start from an infinitesimal statement, and you get a finite one.
For every Lie algebra homomorphism, you would get for free the global action.
In particular, yes. So, and this is the content of Frobenius' theorem, is exactly this globalization statement. Yes?
I think what is non-trivial is that the submanifold is closed.
I know vector fields sometimes are not integrable. I don't know what the failure for them to be. How does that manifest itself? I don't know if it's closeness.
What do you mean by closeness?
Well, if
like this submanifold is generated by the linear algebra, and if we take any two vectors in this linear algebra and take a Lie bracket, it will again lie in the submanifold, not outside the submanifold.
Yeah, so that's exactly the homomorphism of the algebra state, and that's exactly the same thing what I do for the involutive.
So, okay.
But yeah, basically, yet another way of saying it is that you have a certain distribution and you have vector fields. And as you say, like the Frobenius theorem says that if now those, when you take two vector fields, you again end up on the same, what you would call a surface. In general, you don't know a priori if it's a surface or not. But if you lie so on the same tangent plane, you take two vectors here, you take the commutator, and you lie one again on the tangent plane, then you can say that this this tangent plane is the tangent plane of an actual surface that comes from a foliation of your total manifold into some manifold.
So put it slightly differently. So rho are maps from I've been a bit sloppy. So here, in this, what I mean, rho is a map that from a point that takes a point and an element of the Lie algebra to a tangent vector. Instead of thinking of it as a vector field, I look at it point-wise. And so this tells me that at every point I have what is called a distribution, but what this is a collection of tangent vectors at every point. So I have subspaces of my tangent bundle, and now the question is whether they all fit together nicely to be themselves the tangent bundle of a submanifold. So the idea is that, again, taking this, I can have. The problem is, so think of this as a 3D box. And here, at every point, I have a little plane, like this. And the question is whether this plane are all organized to be locally the tangent planes of a surface embedded into this. It's not obvious. It can happen that it's not the case. But if a property like this holds, then you're guaranteed that the manifold exists. OK, so maybe I'll keep the definition for next time. Yes?
Sorry, maybe I missed it, but what is an action? Like
rho? Oh, action, I'm calling rho an action. A rho like this, I call it an action. Yes?
Maybe this is not so much of a question as, some questions, some ideas. So I feel the first part, I was thinking, just like there's an isometric group for a metric, let's mm-hmm. say in a manifold, like flat metrics would give you Poincaré, some killing vector
yep.
fields.
Mm-hmm.
For omega, we discover that, let's say, the isometry of the
Simplectomorphisms
is actually much bigger, right? Is anything that's, when you lower any vector field, if you lower its index, quote unquote, with mm-hmm. the symplectic form, if that gives you the D of something, that's a symplectomorphism.
Yeah, but there are more than those.
There are more than those?
Yes.
That's one thing, that's one question that I had.
Mm-hmm.
Why impose that the vector field, when you lower it, is the D of something? Why not simply impose that it's exact? That would be a symplectomorphism as well.
Well, imposing that it is exact.
Closed, not exact. That's one question that came to mind.
These are two different. So a symplectomorphism. So here the statement is Hamiltonian vector fields are particular examples of symplectomorphisms.
Yeah, and I was
particularly nice ones.
Yeah.
Now symplectomorphisms are a bigger space, but these are so nice because they fit in the diagram. And they're useful for physics. Symplectomorphisms in general, I don't.
it might be interesting to slightly relax the conditions maybe of what one would call a Hamiltonian, and there are different ways of doing it, but I would,
Yeah, and also that made me think also, you keep relaxing even further, why conserve the symplectic form in the first place? Why is that interesting or meaningful?
Why conserving omega is important?
Yeah.
Well, you have one structure on your space, and so there is one thing you can do. So otherwise, you're studying something else. And physically, omega is, we will see, well, omega plays an important physical role, in fact. It's telling you, if you think about quantum mechanics as a quantization of this Poisson bracket, which is related to omega, you know that this omega is actually telling you which Hilbert space structure you're putting on your observable.
Yeah, like that.
So it's a crucial physical input, so that's why it's important.
And what about, one usually uses the omega to define a Poisson bracket, and so I wonder, and I feel a lot of these definitions could have excluded or not used the omega, so I wonder what definitions use omega explicitly?
Yeah, so the omega, so you can use the Poisson bracket to do many of these things, and the point is Poisson geometry as defined by mathematicians, now let's forget about the physics. For mathematicians, Poisson geometry is more general than symplectic geometry, and the caveat, not the caveat, but the hypothesis that is, let me write this because it's an interesting point that I haven't made, even though it's not about physics so much, at least in this course. But so omega is a two-form, non-degenerate, and closed. And we saw that this implies that pi is a bivector, so a bidifferentiation is non-degenerate and satisfies Jacobi. So now the point is this is not required it's not a requirement for a Poisson bivector. A Poisson bivector is a bidifferentiation that satisfies Jacobi. You don't need this. So you can always take an omega and map it to a pi. You might not be able to do the opposite. But this is just a definition of what mathematicians mean by a Poisson manifold. It's a manifold equipped with a bivector, which satisfies the Jacobi equation.
Okay. And the moment one input would impose non-degeneracy, it would be bidirectional?
And then then in finite dimension, they are one-to-one. In infinite dimensions, it's more complicated. No, I'm done. Kevin? Yeah, you're done.